Welcome to Insurgent Imagination, brought to you by Current Movements. Insurgent Imagination explores creative arts through a revolutionary lens. Each episode, we dive into works of radical storytelling to explore how art inspires and supports the movement for collective liberation and how the movement informs artists.
We'll examine work from the past, present, and future, and we'll reflect on their meaning with artists, activists, and revolutionary organizers from around the world.
We hope to provide a welcoming space for folks thinking about the intersection of art and revolution.
Insurgent Imagination is written and produced on the unceded ancestral homelands of the Piscataway, Tonkawa, Payea, and Ohlone peoples. We recognize that this simple land acknowledgement doesn't correct centuries of violence, genocide, and cultural erasure, and we are committed to the restoration of land and sovereignty to Native and Indigenous peoples. For more information about how to support the Land Back movement, visit landback.org.
I'm Katie Pettit, a DC-based organizer and the founder and director of Current Movements.
And I'm Mayuran Tiruchelvam, screenwriter, producer, and assistant professor of social justice fiction filmmaking at San Francisco State University School of Cinema.
In this episode, Mayuran and co-producer Joshua Gamma speak with visual artist Mia Eve Rallo about her practice, including her work with Adelo, a nomadic artist-run project she co-developed in Chiapas, Mexico, with folks from the Zapatista Autonomous Indigenous Movement. So we'd like to introduce Joshua and welcome him to the show. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, Katie. Hi, Mayuran. How are y'all?
Good. Welcome to this side of Insurgent Imagination. We're so happy to have you come on as a host.
Thank you. It feels good to be over here.
Joshua is one of our producers and our editor.
Yes, that's true. Me and Imgard Rupp, we co-produce Insurgent Imagination.
Mm-hmm. We have such a great team. So tell us a little bit about you, who you are, what you do, how you're connected to this podcast, and what you'll be doing on this episode.
Right. Yeah. Who is Joshua Gamma? That's the question that you are asking me. Yes. So I am a designer, a radio producer, a curator. I've been involved with Current Movements for a little over a year now, mostly doing graphic design work early on, moved more into a podcast producer role, but also still doing design work. Mia Eve Rallo, who we're going to speak to in a moment, has an exhibition up at VizArts in Rockville, Maryland, where I'm doing a curatorial residency. So brought her on to Insurgent Imagination because she fits in with what we're talking about. She's interested in solidarity. She's interested in using art as a revolutionary tool, as a way to lift up the voices of people that are not always heard and communicate on a different level. And for her, it's often a spiritual level. It's really beautiful work, and I'm glad we got to talk to her.
I'm excited for our conversation. So normally, we start out our episode, we provide a little context for the listeners about where we are in time and space, relatively speaking. It is early December of 2020. We know who won the U.S. presidential election, although there has been no concession yet made by the loser.
Exactly. And I want to give a big shout out to all of the Black and the Native and POC organizers who allowed for this outcome to be. If they weren't out there organizing for years and months on end, we would have had a very different outcome. And I just really am so grateful for the deep, beautiful organizing that took place, that really, really shifted a really scary possibility. So thank you so much, organizers who got people to the polls, who convinced people to kind of plug their nose and vote for Biden. Yeah, so he's definitely not where we want to be as a country on this side of things, but we are grateful to not have Trump, and we know that we have a lot more work to do, and a lot more is possible in bringing forth the world we want to live in 2021 with a new president. So thank you, thank you, thank you. And if you haven't read the stories of the beautiful organizing that happened around the election, thanks to these groups, we will add those to our show notes so you can dig more into that.
Yeah, it is really through the actions of organizers who have very little representation in government or politics that this election was won. We have to thank those folks because it was a very, very slim, slim victory. And it wouldn't have happened if our people didn't get out there. And on my end, I think I'm supposed to be relieved that there was no full-on fascist coup, which many of us were organizing for and prepared for. But there have been escalating right-wing attacks on people in the weeks afterwards and all kinds of other nonsense going on. So for whatever reason, I feel no relief whatsoever. And I'm wondering about y'all. How are you resting or recovering from what's going on? And what are you doing to kind of slow down a little bit?
Yes. So for me, I think I'm just glad that we're at a point where maybe we can have a little bit more of an adult conversation with our politicians about issues instead of fighting just pure unbridled hatred. So yeah, it's definitely a relief, but also the fact that Trump got such a large percentage of the vote, especially the white vote, it's a good reminder that we're still far, far, far from where we need to be.
You're supposed to be helping me feel better, Joshua.
So I'm sorry. Trumpism is still here, and there's still devotees of his bullshit out in the world. So I do feel some relief. But yeah, the fight's far from over. And like I said earlier, I think we're moving into maybe a few years of having a little bit more of an adult conversation and not like a full-on psychotic meltdown.
Yeah, for me, I felt a pretty instant like weight off my shoulders. That was a sense of relief, but also knowing that, yeah, this isn't it. We're not done. We can't pack our bags and, you know, call it quits for organizing and activism and working towards the world we want to build. So keeping that in mind, I do plan to just slow down more over the holidays and the winter months, really focus on, you know, the people that I want to spend time with, my family and friends in a COVID safe way, and figure out what that can look like. And just kind of reprioritize and balance my life, you know, with activism and organizing, but then all the other things that fulfill me and bring me joy. And just think about how do we keep this sustainable? I think that's always the question.
Well, what do you mean? I mean, we of course will continually talk about sustainable, but what does sustainable mean, actually? Maybe we're not allowed to have this conversation, but I would like to have it because I think it's a term that we use. Mm-hmm. We use it for the environment. We use it for all kinds of things. But what does it actually mean? Does it mean that the people involved aren't getting burned out, or that for every one of us that has a meltdown, somebody else steps into the spot?
I think it's both. I think we need both. I think we need time to be able to step away for years and years at a time and have people to come in and you know, fill our roles in our shoes and bring their own touch of brilliance. And I think we also need to find ways that each of us, if we so choose, can stay in it month to month, year to year. I've had some great conversations this last week with activists who are in their 80s and they're still out there doing it. You know, I would like to be, you know, the grandmother who brought their kids out to all of the things and the protests, and like everybody knows the kids and the grandkids, but it just means that I personally have to find balance.
Well,
Welcome to The Threshold, where we'll take you on a brief journey away from life outside and speak with a revolutionary healer about practices that can help ground us. They'll also share an exercise or practice with us that you can listen to at the close of this episode. So no matter where and when you might be listening to this, resistance is a constant state of being, and we want everyone to take care of themselves and their communities. As Audre Lorde wrote, caring for myself is not self-indulgence, it is self-preservation, and that is an act of political warfare. I like that quote. Today, I am speaking with Sharon Bridgeford, writer and creator of Ritual Jazz Theater, whose list of works, fellowships, teaching accomplishments, and grants is so great that I don't know where to start. Sharon is a Doris Duke performing artist, which if you're in the performing arts, you know is one of the most prestigious awards. Her recent performance, That Black Mermaid Man Lady, premiered in 2018. She hosts and executive produces the podcast Who Your People Is. I'm really excited to have Sharon with us today. Welcome, Sharon, to Insurgent Imagination. It is lovely to have you. And this is the first time that we're speaking.
It's so good to be here. I'm so grateful for this opportunity. And I love the podcast.
Thank you. I'm Myron. I am calling you from San Francisco.
All right.
On Ohlone land. It's the end of a long week. I just finished the semester teaching at San Francisco State, and we're trying to finish up our podcast recording so that everyone can take a break for the year.
That's good and smart and wonderful.
Yes. And Katie told me that you all met at Thousand Currents. Can you tell me a little bit about Thousand Currents and just sort of what you were doing?
Yeah. At the time, myself and my wife, Omi Oshun, Joni Jones, were artists in residence with Thousand Currents. And Thousand Currents basically is a philanthropic organization that funds work being done by women, youth, and Indigenous people in the Global South. And they felt that artists have tools that are important to offer that might help folks that are doing that work connect more deeply with each other and inside of them, their own selves, so that they could offer authentically and more powerfully all that they intend to offer. And so we worked with Thousand Currents for a very long time, but were officially in residence for 2 years. The staff offered work during their gathering that they call the academy, mm-hmm. where basically they were training other people and offering, I wouldn't say training, but offering the way their philosophies and their strategies for partnering with grassroots folk, where those people are the leaders as opposed to a top-down way of working that a lot of institutions work from. They were offering their strategies and methodologies during this retreat that they call the academy. So we offered workshops during the academy. And then also we worked with staff. And then also Thousand Currents supported our creative processes and work.
Sharon, you're also the first person we've interviewed who has their own podcast, which is exciting because you can give me some interviewing tips. Can you tell us about it?
The podcast is called Who Your People Is. So I am a writer that writes for performance. I specifically use African-American Southern migration stories, which is my history, as a way to bring people together for transformative experiences that center spirit and history, our histories, and that activate audiences in ways that engage their accountability as we do the performances. And so I've been a self-employed artist doing this work since 1998. Before that, I was doing the work, and I also had about five jobs, but basically was a community organizer. I was with the first wave of HIV outreach workers, testers, early intervention specialists in Austin, Texas, back in the day. And then when some of my mentors who were mostly women of color, artists who used art as a vehicle for social justice. When they found out I had suitcases of work, they made me pull it out. And then mm-hmm. we use art as a way to get people to access services, as a way to engage our communities. And so I feel like as an artist, I make work that comes from that frame. And it is the architecture for my thought process. So over all these years, I have lots of people that I'm art family with and lots of, you know, new encounters. And I was thinking specifically about my father, who's from Algiers, Louisiana, New Orleans, essentially. He always felt like he knew everybody and he knew their family. And so he didn't mm-hmm. phrase the question this way, but essentially the question, who your people is, I was thinking of him. And nine times out of 10, he did know somebody that you knew or somebody in your family. What I wanted to offer through the podcast was my people that I love and, mm-hmm. you know, to hold space for them to share their experiences, their brilliances, and their work. And so I'm going into, in 2021, I'll have season 3. So there are 2 seasons available now.
It was strange to hear you talk about the opportunities that you took when you first recorded your show to go and see who you could talk to in person. And that seems like such a long ago custom, you know, almost like another life, given that we've been shut in for so long. So I was wondering how you maintain your sense of community and your creative community as we are all separated.
Yeah, it's a real strange time. It's interestingly enough, I feel like I work a lot right now and mm-hmm. I'm kind of exhausted. And I do feel like I've had lots of deep connections with folks. I think because for myself, I, you know, coming from a community organizing background, I thankfully was taught long ago as an artist to create the life I want to live mm-hmm. and to have the work that I do be centered in what I feel my purpose is. And so part of what then happens is I am really committed to long-term ongoing relationships. Mm-hmm. And so for me as a touring artist in the past, that has meant that I get to keep showing up to places, mm-hmm. returning to places, and then also always having new experiences and new communities that I connect with. But when I connect, I connect. So there's an ongoing relationship. Mm-hmm. And I think that has served me, thank goodness, because I have been in ongoing conversations with people through Zoom, mm-hmm. through telephone. We have a really small pod that we're tight with, in-person stuff with. But I have felt very connected and I have been able to show up through doing a lot of workshops, a lot of different kinds of offerings, and then receiving offerings from people. And then just my like phone call shout outs with my homies. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then as I move towards creating pieces, which I'm in a creation process right now, where mm-hmm. I'm creating a new piece. And so right now I'm just writing, but I don't know what's going to be like when it's time mm-hmm. to play with others with this mm-hmm. piece. But I do come from a lineage of artists that are deeply, deeply innovative. And mm-hmm. so I imagine that, you know, we'll figure it out.
There have been generations ahead of us that have figured out how to create under duress, under the harshest conditions and kind of endure. So that's actually really lovely to hear. I don't know if I'm allowed to use the word jealous, but I'm envious of your being in a creative phase because I think a lot of us are stuck.
I think it's complex and it's different for different people. And, you know, oh God, there's just so much going on that is unimaginable and that we won't know for a long time and we may never know. So, but for myself personally, all of my work is rooted in my own healing. So it starts in what my mentor, Lori Carlos, used to call the bone marrow. So it starts there. And then with rigor and tending and creative process and collaboration and experiences, it becomes itself. But I think because I'm rooted in healing, both mm-hmm. in my own self, but for the purpose of also hopefully offering transformative healing experiences and connections for others, that is how I live. So I think this commitment to connection and practice of healing starting inside, and then hopefully as support and witness is the thing that guides me. And then I have to say, again, thinking about my family, my father, you know, all of my older blood family, because so much of my work is around looking at who they are, the context of their lives, history that we come from, and all of that. What I know is that these Southern Black people practice joy as a transgressive act of self-determination. So we're going to have a good time. And we're going to invite each other into that good time. A lot of mayhem may happen. Things may go down, but we're going to dance. We're going to eat. We're going to laugh. Prayers get prayed and we show up. And so that is very instructive for me. And it's something that I seek to create inside of the worlds of my work, but also in my own life. And it's probably saved my life. So many people, I can name so many people that have saved my life because I don't think that I was always able to do that. I had to grow into that, and people helped me along the way. And I hope I do that with others as I'm able. I think my facilitation, my work in community is around this exact thing. I think as an artist, as an activist, as a scholar, as whatever you are, if you're not rooted in your own voice and your own story, you're not as powerful as you're capable of being. And you are therefore doing a disservice to everybody. And so I think for me, it's about going in and finding that bone marrow that is yours. And it may be painful. And you may not be able to do it. I drank for a long time because I couldn't access it. So I don't think Black people or anybody can necessarily always do this. But I think it is the opportunity. And so how do you heal yourself so that you can stand in your own light, supported by your ancestors of light and progress, and fulfill your mission in life? Which, you know, for me as an artist, that's the purpose. So for everybody, some people are adopted. Some people don't know their blood family history and stories, but we have imagination and we can research. So going in to heal and to stand firmly inside of our inheritance, I think is number one. And then after that, you see what you do with that. So I think for myself, when I do workshops, when I facilitate, when I worked with the Academy at the Thousand Currents, like that's what I was focused on. And so I think one of the things that it does is it helps us to hear better. It helps us to be more present, and it helps us to access our own intentions more powerfully. So I think it's necessary for everybody. And again, I just can't say strong enough, it like how you do it and the tools that you have to do it with, like it varies widely at different times in our lives and with different people.
I wish we had had this conversation yesterday so that I could quote you. I could have quoted you in my last class of the semester because there are motorcycle riders in my neighborhood.
Yeah, you know,
you got to get the youngsters do their thing. You know, it's the only thing that makes them happy right now. So, but yeah, at the end of the semester, you know, trying to be able to say something optimistic to young creative people is not always easy. So,
yeah,
I always try. I have to quote from folks who are wiser than me, or at least more articulate, because nobody's necessarily been in this moment before, but we've all been in our moment before.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I want to ask you about the Black Mermaid Man Lady project, which sounds really awesome. And I know that piece is also influencing the kind of offering that you're going to be doing with us.
Thank you. Yeah. So it's That Black Mermaid Man Lady, like that, like who that, you know? And it's a lot of different things. It's a project that has a lot of different parts to it. One of them is it's a show. So that was the first thing that I did, was I wrote this show and then developed it over time. And it was premiered in Minneapolis at Pillsbury House Theater in 2018. I have six parents because of divorces and stuff like that. At the time that I was writing it, three of my six parents died. Oh. And so I started, and I had like already in all of my work, as I said, I've been really digging into our histories, mm-hmm. healing, figuring out how to just be love more, like how to be, how the evidence of spirituality to me is joy. And if I'm blocking love, I don't think I'm fully in my joy. I was in this point of real celebration of them and just really, it's not that they said anything that I wrote, but mm-hmm. their essence was driving me. Mm-hmm. And I finished writing the show and they just, it was like these characters just kept talking. Mm-hmm. And so at the same time, I'm a spiritual seeker and had done a lot with Yoruba spiritual traditions and oracle decks and mm-hmm. different kinds of cosmologies. And so I was like, I'm going to make you oracles, mm-hmm. these characters. And then you can talk as much as you want to talk for a long, long time. And so there are nine oracles. There are each characters in the show. Mm-hmm. And each oracle speaks on four things. If the card is blank, it means you already know, so there's nothing to say about it. But the other text that is on the back of the cards is text from the script. Mm. And for the oracle deck, the visual art is by Yasmin Fernandez. And mm-hmm. so we collaborated, and I was just very fortunate to have her glorious art on this deck. So I started doing these Dat Black Mermaid Man Lady oracle readings in different kinds of settings and in different ways. Mm-hmm. And one of them was, there is a Dat Black Mermaid Man Lady performance installation where I was installed in a room doing these readings and also asking other people, the audience, to mm-hmm. create what I call blessings and, mm-hmm. and engage out loud in conversation with each other. And with that project, my collaborators were Walter Katundu and my daughter, Sonia Perryman. So there was singing, there was this beautiful music that Sonia and Walter created, and this interactive experience that included me doing readings.
Hmm. And you were talking about your parents passing, and I want to acknowledge that. Would you say that part of the grieving was this creativity?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for that. Absolutely. So three of them are still alive, but the three that passed were my blood father and my daughter's father's parents, mm-hmm. who remained my parents, even though he and I divorced. Mm-hmm. And so my daughter, who was collaborating with me on the performance installation, we would just tell each other stories and laugh hysterically. Mm-hmm. And also get these real sparks of understanding them more and appreciation of them more. It presents them with us in a powerful way. And I do think it helped us move through grief with a lot of light mm-hmm. and with a lot of like L-I-G-H-T light mm-hmm. And with each other.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That is inspiring because it shows that we can all figure out ways, even if we haven't yet, to create through our grief, perhaps, yeah. in the moment yeah. that we're in. I feel like we could talk probably for days about this. So thank you for sharing not just about your process and your journey, but about some of the potential that we have, we meaning all the folks out here, to use the moment that we're in, you know, in more creative ways.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for your beautiful questions and just for giving space and doing the work to make these podcasts available.
So we can find your show, whoyourpeopleis.com. Okay. And that blackmermaidmanlady.com?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, we'll put all that in the show notes so that people can see your work. But I do hope that we get to come together soon, and thank you for giving us your time.
Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to the time when we can all come together in person soon. And just blessings to everybody.
I'm very excited today to speak with artist Mia E. Rollo. Mia co-developed Idelo, a nomadic artist-run project in Chiapas, Mexico, with folks from the Zapatista Autonomous Indigenous Movement. This movement is one of my biggest inspirations. Mia's solo exhibition, The Sailing Stones Act, is currently on view at Viz Arts in Rockville, Maryland. Her work centers on intersectionality as a nucleus for engagement around themes of movement, tying together notions of ableism, human displacement, and generational traumas. Land and human rights, child labor and femicide, autonomy and self-determination. I'm joined for this conversation by our co-producer, Joshua Gamma. Just to begin, could you please introduce yourself? Tell us about your journey as an artist, as a human being, as an activist, and then also tell us what some of your influences are or inspirations.
Yeah, I was born in Chicago, 84, come from a middle class white family, divorced parents, actually hard upbringing. A lot of like moving around, switching schools. I had a difficult time in school, so I always was using art as my sanctuary space. Nothing else in the world seemed to really make sense to me. So from an early age, I found kind of truth in even performance art and interacting with reality in certain ways, questioning reality in certain ways from a very young age. The rebellious side of me was like very strong and at play just because I was in conflict with what I saw around me. So, you know, like growing up in the south side of Chicago was where I spent my young days. And I was living with my mom at that time and they put me in a private school. So it was just not a place that got along with me. So anyway, I followed my art path, and I could say within art, it was this magical place. So a place where I could talk to spirits, whether it be animals or nature. Also, you know, I was reading tarot cards at a young age, so like aware of all these different realms that are around us. And I followed that, and I'm still that same little girl. I started to grow within the human world more in graduate school. So I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago in 2007 in the sculpture department. And there I was in an automobile accident in the middle of the night and basically had a very death experience, kind of went and came back. You know, when I went 6 months later, I returned back to school and I became really close with a person in my department, Caleb Duarte. And he was one of the, you know, the Art Institute of Chicago, at least at that time, was not a very diverse place. The schooling that I had up until then was also very privileged white experience. I think through gaining a disability and also this relationship with Caleb, he's a very activist, political, aware person and artist. So through kind of this whole experience that came into my life, I started to kind of interact more with the human world. So I guess, you know, just being in a wheelchair, you know, being in the streets of Chicago, a different demographic would start to come up to me and share with me their stories, you know, fellow differently abled people. And so from there, I kind of got a reality check into like the struggles that people are going through. And that became a very important part of kind of who I am. From there, I guess we graduated, we went to Mexico. Caleb invited me to open an art space, kind of an experimental art space inspired by the Zapatistas.
We have lots of questions about that for...
Yeah, so yeah. It goes from there.
Yeah, you're definitely answering some of my questions already, which is great. One thing that I really admire is the accountability that you have to the communities that you're working with. And, you know, these aren't quick projects. Like, you were in Chiapas, what, like 5 years? Is that correct?
Yeah, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. I know a lot of artists want to get involved with work that's, you know, kind of community oriented, social practice kind of artwork, but sometimes aren't as keyed into like how important the accountability is. So I'm just curious if you could talk a little bit about like your process in terms of like how you choose to work with people, how you nurture relationships. And you were starting to talk about like the beginning of Idelo. So maybe that's a place we could start and just talk about like how that came about and the process of really making that about relationships with people.
Yeah. So actually, I think I can tie the accountability into Idelo really easily because Idelo was, you know, initially it was just an idea to go to San Cristobal. We were inspired by the Zapatistas and to open an experimental art space. And when we got there, it turned out that the building where the United Nations was in San Cristobal was being occupied by a displaced community.
Wow.
So this community was, you know, displaced by the government, like many communities are. And they were living in the central plaza in tents, and they would come every day to the building of the UN and try and gain humanitarian attention. And the UN ignored them, I think, for 3 months, something like that. And so the UN eventually decided to find another building, and they moved. When we got there, the UN building was kind of being occupied by this community, kind of just vacant. You know, it was the perfect building and idea for this project. Like, how do artists come into an institutional space that is supposed to have accountability to the people and is not doing their job? And how, as artists, can we actually take that supposed role and have that accountability to the people that we're supposed to be serving? So we named our project Idelo en donde era la ONU, which is where the United Nations used to be. It's an acronym that means that. So we kind of held the name to reinforce this idea of artists taking over these institutional spaces and looking at how we can use experimentation and how we can use collaboration and how we can use really love and, you know, engagement with community and how through art we can change that kind of narrative and actually do something for people. So it was a really interesting project. You know, it was inspired by the Zapatistas. The Zapatistas are a group of people who really know how to listen. You know, they're very humble people who listen to the flowers, listen to the voices of their brothers and sisters. And so we, as, you know, people who weren't from there, that was one of our biggest assets. We're able to be good listeners. Really, the people who came in to this space were the people who animated the space. You know, we had a residency program, we had workshops, we had conferences, we had huge cultural event nights and days. We had a school for working children. We are kind of a safe house for the community. So different community members who needed anything could come, get a meal, sleep over, get a, you know, a shower. You know, at one point, this was one of my favorite periods, our like that center turned into a space center because we were hosting a resident, Rigo, 23, and his project was to work with Zapatistas and other artists in the area, creating a Zapatista spaceship. And then when he left, let's say dancers came in. So then we became focused on dance. So it was just kind of this ever-changing kind of laboratory for collaboration from people from different backgrounds and different cultures. And I think that idea was really important because, you know, in a world where we're so much told that, you know, I am me and you are the other, it was kind of erasing these ideas of otherness, you know, and finding common ground through imagination, art, and creating together.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Was there like a initial connection? Did like Caleb, did he have connection to folks down there?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yes. So when we were in grad school in Chicago, he was, so Caleb is Chicano, mm-hmm. and he was, you know, one of the only, not one of the only, but of there was the Chicago in our department and in the grad school and in the undergrad was not a diverse place.
Right.
Caleb had connection to the Museum of Mexican Art, I believe, in Chicago. So they invited him to go to Chiapas to have an exhibit with several other people from Chicago. I mean, I remember when he came back, he had gotten some little Zapatista paintings, maybe like five of them, and he showed them to me, and he was just taken by the magic and the innocence and the truth that he could see within these paintings. You know, they're able to see reality in a way that's not been brainwashed. There's a real wisdom that they hold. I've actually found that to be very true with the Zapatista landscape, like mental landscape. A lot of the people who I've met there really have held on, even though they live a life that has a lot of struggle and they're very strong in their resistance. I think part of what they've resisted is this like adult darkness that's taken us all over in these colonial times.
Totally. Yeah. So the Zapatistas, we're probably used to outsiders coming in that are curious about what they're doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's kind of it's a constant pot of at least, if you're in a Zapatista central caracol, there's always people coming through.
Yeah. Yeah. And they embrace it. I mean,
that's cool.
More and more they embrace, you know, people coming in and, you know, sharing information.
That's one thing I've always been fascinated about the Zapatistas is like their use of technology to have a worldwide reach. So I could see them being very open to having outsiders come in, learn from them, and them learn from the outside world as well. That's cool. The big overall feeling that I really got from the exhibition was this feeling of mystery and joy. And it was really a beautiful experience. And I think in the US, there's kind of this stereotype of like political work being kind of like hard or angry or, you know, very didactic. So it's always lovely when work that is imbued with politics is beautiful. And I know that you're very interested in dreams and shamanism and psychomagic and things like that. Watching these videos in the exhibition, you know, it feels like we're watching some kind of ceremony, and we're like outsiders, but we're also invited to be participants, you know? So I'm just curious about your relationship to the kind of spiritual, mystical realm and how it influences your work, and maybe just talk about that approach to art and like how like spiritual art can have like a political agenda without being so hard hitting, or not that it's not hard hitting, but that it's not kind of didactic messaging.
Thank you for all those comments about the work. I really appreciate that. So yeah, my spiritual practice or world, you know, really comes from what I was mentioning when I was little. You know, I've always had just a very strong connection to the subtle worlds that are around us. I actually think that I'm kind of more comfortable in those worlds than I am in kind of the man-made world. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always had a really strong connection to symbols that I see around me. Or when I meet certain people, I can kind of read them pretty well, I think. You know, there's many ways that this plays within my life, these metaphysical experiences or these maybe psychic experiences or ways that time seems more spiral instead of linear. And, you know, my dreams have always been a place of a lot of insight for myself. And so really, I think it's the rational world is not really a world that I am interested in, but it's more of the non-rational. So, you know, I think a lot of the work and a lot of the place that I go into with people who I'm collaborating with exactly that. So it's like taking away all of these human-made ways of seeing each other, the superficial, and really going into the complexities of the spirits that surround us, the symbols that surround us, the histories that where we come from, the significance of the land that we've traversed, you mm-hmm. know, the memories that are in our headspace, you know, finding those places within people and, you know, using those as a place to connect with people and create a meaningful relationship with people and do some sort of art practice with people, whatever it may be. So it's pretty open. And yeah, I think that's what ends up happening. I think how that can relate to political work, political artwork. You know, one of the reasons why I was so inspired by going to Mexico and inspired by the Zapatistas is their use of art and poetry and their understanding of life is in a very non-rational way. It's the most truthful way as well. It's to the point. I'm pretty inspired by the concept of the dignified rebellion, dignity being the refusal to accept humiliation and dehumanization, the refusal to conform, turning struggle into liberation. These are all central principles mm-hmm. of their struggle. They're able to turn power dynamics around by making revolution a question rather than an answer. Preguntando caminamos, like asking as we walk. So it's a different way of thinking. You know, you could say it's political, but I think political is a very little word. Yeah. Like in the US, people are saying the far left is people who are fighting for clean water,
right.
and a healthy planet, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's really interesting to come back here to the US during this time and hear these petty, horrible arguments
right.
that just don't make any sense whatsoever when I've been spending a decade with communities who really know what to fight for and know the power of art and poetry. And it's like this deep soul connection.
I'm always a bad podcast host because I always start crying when I listen to people talking. It's about people being able to speak their truth. And also, it's very rare for people to acknowledge that the world that we live in, the so-called material world, and I say this as a materialist, is bullshit, right? It's created to constrain and oppress and crush and suffocate and abuse people. And so, you know, being able to find little portals outside of that experience is one of the things that I feel like we're just lucky when we have that experience, when we have that opportunity or somebody to show us that that's possible. I wanted to tangent slightly on based from what I've written, because so Mia, I've seen your work only through looking at all the pieces on your website, and particularly the video documentation that you've made of your projects. And I was really just fascinated by the process of documenting, because so much of site-specific artwork is ephemeral in a way. People who are there get to see it and experience it, and it stays with them. The intention is not for that thing to be there forever. And in film, at least, people have this expectation of permanence, you know, that everything you do has to last forever and matter. So I was just curious about how and why you started documenting your process and your projects, and whether your intention was to so that you could keep sharing it with people. I'm curious about that, just because I am fascinated by that approach.
Well, there's actually a lot of the work is not documented. So if you take one of the projects that are on the website, maybe 1/10 of actually what happened in my interaction with those communities is actually taken, my camera clicks. So there's a lot of the work that is living with people, going to weddings, going to...
Yeah.
You know, rituals, eating together, doing chores, laughing together. I mean, there's just like, there's a lot that is behind the work. When I actually take my camera out, usually it is for a specific performance. And I think part of the idea for that is to be able to share whatever we're doing with the world community. For example, I was in Palestine, I think 2 years ago now it was, and part of the idea there was that the people who I was working with, I was living with a refugee family, and within that refugee camp, there's many disabled people due to the occupation. And so we were interviewing, we meaning the family that I was living with. The father of the family who I was living with had really severe schizophrenia because he spent 12 years being tortured in prison. And so the son in the family was around my age, and he wanted to work with me and start to interview differently abled people in the camp. And so we started to do these interviews. And from the interviews, I kind of brought the tool of performance, and, you know, they decided, yeah, they wanted to, you know, come up with several performances that would reenact the pain that they've gone through, but also push through the pain and kind of like show why it is they're still able to hold on to life. And so they really were excited by the fact that I had the ability to share their stories. So the filming then takes on that role of being the tool that can bring someone's ideas from a little camp in Palestine and share it with people around the world. I'm not really on that big of a platform, but hopefully someday people can start to see the work within the kind of documentation. It's kind of like a residue of a spirit. If we're creating some sort of spirit in capturing it, this kind of like communal, telepathic, ritual kind of happening, it's interesting to me to be able to capture part of it and then to show it to a community on the other side of the world who may be also going through a similar trauma or a similar joy or, you know, a similar resistance. Because I think that these kind of non-rational, like these subconscious kind of connections, these weavings of, I don't know, of experience can form some sort of solidarity, some sort of unity. And I think that, you know, in a world today, you know, a lot of what I dream is, you know, the people rising up and rising together and taking away capitalism. When I was in Palestine, for example, within the camp, it actually reminded me a lot of being with Zapatistas, because there was a certain solidarity that they had among themselves and a certain, you know, a certain brotherhood or sisterhood, a certain way of living that felt so familiar. And, you know, that work can be, we could build that in the borderlands of Mexico, which I think we'll probably do. We could build that in Palestine. It would make sense there. You know, so it's just these worldwide issues of people fighting for life.
I have asked all and received more wisdom and answers than I could ever ask questions for. Thank you so much. And
yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for the time that you spent looking at the work and asking me these questions. I really appreciated the conversation. I hope that we can stay in touch and
yeah,
meet in person someday.
Yeah, that would be great. How much longer is your exhibition at VisArts up?
Yeah, it closes January 5th.
January 5th. Okay.
Yeah.
Great. If folks are listening and they're in the DC, Virginia, Maryland area, recommend you get down to VisArts and check out the show. It's really beautiful. The Sailing Stones Act.
Yeah, and it's safe to go there because they're only letting in like one party at a time. So you have to call before you go and then...
Appointment only. Yeah.
And are there any other things you'd like to shout out for us on the show? We'll definitely share in the show notes, we'll share all the links to the things that you've talked about.
No. Shout out to all the stars in the sky.
Thank you. I'm so happy that we got to have this talk.
Yeah, me too.
If you enjoyed this show, please consider supporting Current Movements on Patreon. Your donations are greatly appreciated. This week, we'd like to acknowledge the support of our newest Patreon, Alana. Production of this series is sponsored by VizArts in Rockville, Maryland, and San Francisco State University School of Cinema, College of Liberal Arts and Creative Arts, and the George and Judy Marcus Funds for Excellence in the Arts. Insurgent Imagination is produced by Imgard Rott and Joshua Gamma and written and produced by Katie Pettit and Mayoran Tiruchelvam from our respective pandemic locales in Baltimore, San Antonio, and San Francisco. Our theme song, There Are Black People in the Future, is by Lavender Freddy.
Yeah, no, this is great. I'll just do it. And what I'll do is I'll pull one card from the That Black Mermaid Man Lady blessing deck and then one oracle card. And okay. After each card, I will offer a prompt. Mm-hmm. And so people that listen, if they want to, can write the prompt down and use it as like a journaling, you know, something to walk with. Mm-hmm. Something to respond to. I'll pull a blessing first. And there's lots about all of this on the That Black Mermaid Man Lady website. Mm-hmm. With the them blessings, essentially at first I was writing to my child self. I was just thinking about my 8-year-old self. And I was like, man, I wish I could tell that child some things that would have made the road easier. And then as I kept writing, I began to feel that, oh, actually, this child is talking to me. And then, you know, it just kept kind of unfolding and essentially became itself. But it's a soul conversation. And let's see. My question is always, what blessing does love want us to receive? Okay. It's number 26. Remember, rest. It's okay. Rest. Be still. Just for now. Rest. Even for a moment. Rest. So I feel that the prompt for this is rest. Mm-hmm. It's not a question. It's just rest. And then as you think about resting, any resistance that comes up or any time that you can't do it, follow that and see what is being offered to you through that experience, that struggle, that questioning, that resistance. Rest. Okay, now I'm going to pull an oracle card. And so Yasmin Hernandez did the artwork. And as I said, there are 9 oracles. They're each characters from the show. And the things that they say are actually text from the script. And if the card is blank, it means you already know. This is an ancestor deck, so it's all about love. It's an ocean deck, so it's about what's under the surface. And yeah, my question is, what does love or infinite love want us to know right now? 2 came out, so I'm going to actually do two. One popped out, so I figured it's for us. So the first one is honeypot. In the world of this piece, because this work is within not only an African-American Southern migration tradition, culture, cosmology, but a Yoruba spiritual cosmology. So in the world of this piece, this is Oya, divine change, honey, change. The character's name is Honeypot. And she says, pay attention. I wish I had one more moment with you. If I had one more moment with you, I'd look you in your eyes and say, I know you're never far away. I'd say, I love you. So I feel that the opportunity here is to pay attention to the people that you love. And maybe if there is one person in particular that's on your heart or in your spirit that you've been a little distant from, you know, someone where it's a safe and good relationship, pay attention, offer your love, be present for it. This is about grief. I actually wrote this. It's part of a song, but I wrote it for my father. Ooh. And then the other one that came, that jumped out, this is Divine Opportunity. In the world of the piece, he's called O Caney Sharp. It's Legba. So this is at the crossroads. There's always a divine opportunity. Personally, and within the world of the piece, there's no right or wrong. You just make choices and then things unfold and you always get to learn and grow and shift. It says, what is the truth? Let your questions go. You ain't got to know. You thinks too much. That's why you stuck. Get on up and fly. So my prompt or my offering is, what are you holding on to that is keeping you from flying right now? What are you holding on to that is keeping you from flying right now? That's it.